Welcome to Grumpy Strategists. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm delighted to have the second in our Ambassadors series. I'm talking today with Ukrainian Ambassador Vasyl Miroshnichenko. Ambassador, it's my delight to have you on the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. It's a great pleasure and honor for me to be working and representing Ukraine in Australia. That's probably the most rewarding job I ever had. As you know, I worked for myself for 20 years. I was my own business, and I was always involved in foreign affairs all my life, one way or another, as a student of international relations, later as a practitioner, but still kind of mostly working with the government, but never as part of the government, but supporting Ukraine on public diplomacy, economic diplomacy, and investment promotion, and then also fighting Russian disinformation, which I was heavily engaged in starting from the first Russian invasion in 2014. And of course, when President Zelensky appointed me as an ambassador to Australia, I couldn't really believe it, to be frank. I was still kind of...
How did you get the call? Were you
at
a restaurant, sitting in the bath?
Well, it's a complicated long story, but to make it simple, I kind of was interested in becoming an ambassador for the past 8 years before that. So pretty much starting from the first invasion of Ukraine, I thought of, look, I'm in my own business doing lobbying, doing public affairs and whatnot. And I always was fascinated. It was a job in foreign service. Well, originally I was trained to become a diplomat. And, you know, in Ukraine, which we have still inherited the legacy of the Soviet Union, yes, you go to one specific university before you can enroll into foreign service. That's like in it's called Kyiv Institute of International Relations, which is part of the National University. In Moscow, it's MGIMO, which is Moscow State Institute of International Relations.
The Washington equivalent, Georgetown.
Correct. Georgetown or Johns Hopkins or Tufts, Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, in a way. But yeah, Georgetown would be more equivalent. But I think our still kind of Soviet education, because it was in the 90s, it was like Soviet Union collapsed. But I mean, the style and everything was still very Soviet. I mean, pretty much.
The state inherited all
that. We inherited that. And you know, and I enjoyed that time, actually. But I just couldn't afford to go into foreign service when I graduated, because I got married early. I couldn't afford working for the government, and you know, the government job in those days was $100 per month, and I already had my daughter, and I just said, I mean, it was not really
it's not gonna work.
So private sector and business was the most attractive one for me. But 20 years later I became an ambassador, and it's an honor to be able to help Ukraine in this dark times for Ukraine. And you know, it's a huge privilege and an honor to be serving in Australia, and I'm very lucky to be here. I'm also an ambassador to New Zealand as well.
You're
such a vibrant democracy, open society. You know, this is what I enjoy.
But I think one of your big roles that you play so effectively is you bring news of the outside world into Australia, because we're a long way away from Europe. But the gravity of the war in Europe, not just for Ukraine, but for the whole of Europe and the wider world, I think that message just needs repeating and repeating and repeating. And so your role in just reminding Australians that in a crowded information space where we get distracted, this war matters, not just to Ukraine and the Ukrainian people, not just to Europe, but to us down here in Australia.
100%. And by the way, you just used long way away, and that was something that the line that was used by many politicians in Australia in 2022. And I didn't like that phrase, to be frank, because actually it's not that long way away. Just a quick, 22-hour flight.
Well, true. Lots of Australians make that distant flight all the time.
It would be a very quick flight, to Dubai and then to Kyiv, and you could do it. But what's important is not the distance. It's actually how this Russia's war in Ukraine has evolved and how it has involved countries in your part of the world. The intensive cooperation with North Korea, with North Korean troops fighting now Ukrainians in Russia.
I think about half of Russia's ammunition supply is now North Korea.
From North Korea, and all the benefit that China is getting from that cooperation with Russia, and how they are using that for their geopolitical benefit, intensive cooperation between Iran and Russia. And look, I mean, let's just face it. You have to look into this, Indonesia kind of foreign policy and how strategic it is for Australia's, security.
Well, the Prabowo government is continuing the Indonesian policy of friends to all, enemies to none. But inside that, President Prabowo made his first visit He made a visit to Moscow even before he became the president, after he was elected.
And Michael, what's important, because they always reference non-alignment movement, right? Mm. Being one of the founders of non-alignment, and when they hosted this Bandung conference in 1955, they, you know, attracted India, they attracted South Africa, Brazil, and other countries, which are now have kind of become, a lot of that is now part of BRICS in a way, partially.
Which is an emerging bloc of some kind.
It's correct, which is now an economic bloc, yeah. But you might have seen the comments from Lula da Silva when he spoke about a reaction to President Trump's tariffs imposed on India over the fact that they are buying Russian oil.
Yes.
He said that we should be working together much more intensively to counteract America. And this is immediately India sent an envoy to China, they sent an envoy to Moscow to coordinate that response. And Brazil has been also a big powerhouse globally, how they are reacting to that. Indonesia, kind of in a way, by the way, I mean, the main principle of non-alignment is non-aggression.
Yes.
In 2022, Indonesia supported the UN resolution condemning Russian aggression in Ukraine. So they did vote in, you know, 141 countries supported that resolution.
But they're in a big company at the time, weren't they? And it's what you do after that. I'm quite concerned to see the deepening Indonesian-Russian military cooperation and space cooperation. I think we've got to take it seriously.
Absolutely. And you've seen the joint naval exercises in November of last year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a public domain. They've hosted Russian military vessels just 1,300 kilometers away from Darwin.
Yeah, so we had that controversy here about three Chinese warships circumnavigating Australia, but we didn't pay as much attention to that Russian military presence. And I think this is the point you're making about Russia and Ukraine are actually not that distant. It is a connected world.
100%, and Russia maintains a large Pacific fleet. I mean, look what they have in Vladivostok. How many fighter jets, how many nuclear submarines Russians have in the Far East?
They've been joint exercises with the Chinese 100%. Increasingly, including near Japan. So I think that point about connection is worth having at the top of our mind.
No, and it's also, by the way, I mean, I have a personal story, which is, you know, kind of mind-boggling for me right now. I mean, it just how ironic that could be. I mentioned my granddad when you came here. So my grandfather comes from Eastern Ukraine, from Kharkiv region. His father, who I was named after, Vasil, he was killed in 1941 when Nazis were coming all the way. He used to work for a railway station, but he was drafted immediately, and he had some small arms to stop German tanks rolling in, and he was killed immediately. But his son, Ivan, he was drafted in 1943 at the age of 17. He went through training, and then he actually was involved in liberating Ukraine and Budapest from the Nazi. Interestingly enough, in the 50s, he carried on with the Soviet army, and he was sent to the occupied territories of Japan. And he served for 3 years in Iturup, which were those islands which Soviet Union occupied after the defeat of Japan.
Yes, it was one of the outcomes of the Yalta Conference.
No, it was not actually an outcome. So it's not, I mean, it's nobody recognizes that.
Well, I've just been reading a history of the Yalta Conference written by a Ukrainian scholar.
Serhii Pulhi?
Yes.
He's very good. Yeah.
Wonderful book, full of research from Soviet archives
that
opened under the Gorbachev era. And he talks about the sort of side deals around Russian control of Japanese territory.
Kuril Islands. Yeah. And so my grandfather served there for at least 3 years in the late 50s. And he didn't take his son, my dad, with him because those were very harsh conditions. And I remember, so my father lived with his grandparents somewhere actually in Sumy Oblast on the border with Russia, by the way. It was in eastern Ukraine. Apparently, absolutely. And because my grandfather, I mean, I love those stories about his time on Iturup Island, because he told us, look, we had no food, but there was lots of fish and bamboo in very harsh winters, you know, and only every 6 months we'd get a ferry from Vladivostok or from, you know, with some food.
With some vegetables.
And people were, people were losing their teeth because there was not enough.
Scurvy.
So they were getting sick and all of that. So in a way, you know, what's quite striking that my grandfather ended up living until the age of 95, and he died in January of 2022, basically 1 month before the major invasion happened. So all his life he was in the Soviet military.
He
was also
fought with Russian
forces. Yeah, he was part of the
Russian forces to liberate Europe.
From the Nazi.
Then he serves over in the Pacific.
And then he later on served in the 60s, he served in Eastern Germany. So my father went to a Soviet school and actually my grandmother was a principal of that school in Eastern Germany, you know, where the Soviet military was stationed. And if you look at the casualties in the Second World War, out of 26 million Soviet casualties, 12 million were Ukrainian, 7 million Belarus, and then the rest Russians and Georgians and others, right? So if you look at how much we suffered during the Second World War, most of the battlefield was there in Ukraine, in Belarus.
Yes.
I mean, because, you know, Nazi occupied it entirely, yes, then they fought
the
back.
The war passed through there twice.
So yeah. Bloodlands of Europe, this is what Professor Timothy Snyder is talking about in his book, was a lot about how much we have suffered in the Second World War, you know? And in a way, now Russians are waging the largest war since 1945, the 1940s. I mean, on the European continent, with 650,000 Russian troops deployed on the ground, and the level of destruction and the kind of weapons that Russians are using, it's just unbelievable, right? I mean, it cannot be compared to anything. And when people talk about, I don't want to be making references to other conflicts in the world, but any other conflict in the world at the moment cannot be compared in scale and magnitude to what is happening in Ukraine.
Magnitude and sophistication of the forces being used on both sides. So one of the most disturbing developments has been the re-energizing of the Russian defense industrial base, enabled by Chinese technology and funding and all of the money from Russian oil, which we can talk about briefly. But that sort of rebuilding of the Russian military production system to bring in drone technology, counter-drone technology, increase their missile production. At the start of the war, everyone was saying they're pulling everything out of old Soviet-era stockpiles. They're still doing that to an extent, and they're running short of things, but their new production has been really enabled by that partnership, I think particularly with China.
100%. And you see, in our case, we are thankful to the countries who have come to support us, like the US, EU, Britain, Australia, from the very beginning. And Russia has been cooperating with North Korea, Iran, China in that respect. And even the most efficient drone that Russians are now using is called Garan, which is based on a Shahed drone from Iran.
With full Iranian cooperation.
And they've helped them to set up production in Russia of that drone, which can carry up to 40 kilograms of energetics, and they come and destroy and kill Ukrainians and destroy
it's
another civilian infrastructure.
It's been used in very large numbers, hasn't it? 100 of those drones.
Yeah, at a time.
Are taking Kiev.
Yeah, yeah, Kiev and other cities. So last year we had like 30 drones at a time when we called it a massive attack. Now we get 500 or 800 at a time at different targets. And imagine, how can you counteract that? They're just overwhelming our air defense systems. And then you also need to have a lot of that. And this is where we still rely on our Western partners in terms of supply the ammunition for air defense, especially for cruise or ballistic missiles, because, I mean, this is where America has a monopoly.
No escape from those expensive interceptors, is there?
Correct.
When you're dealing with ballistic missiles that are coming at high speed in numbers. So you can deal with the cheaper, slower drones, but those expensive interceptors are essential for those more powerful weapons.
And the way they do it, so like they send all those drones in swarms. By the way, a lot of them are just decoys. Some of them don't even have any TNT or whatever, because there are many. You need to shoot down everything because you don't know which one got the weapon.
It's got the payload and which one.
Correct. And then I was in Kyiv now more recently. And Michael, I experienced two major attacks at Kyiv. And it's a very confronting experience. Nighttime, 1 o'clock in the morning. Both times. And so still jet lag, so went to bed around 9 p.m. because I was already, exhausted.
You're asleep.
Yeah, you're asleep and you just wake up hearing explosions.
Right.
And my apartment is on the 17th floor and it's very loud. So all windows are open because it's bloody hot in Kyiv right now. July, it's unbearable, and August is the same thing. So everybody keeps their windows open because otherwise you can't sleep. It's too hot. And then you hear explosions, and then you hear this extremely unpleasant sound of the drones, which sounds like a motorcycle flying, basically.
Yes.
And that sound, okay, and you literally hear them over your house.
Yes.
You feel like it's going to hit your house now.
And
right?
You know what the sound means.
Yeah, we know what the sound is, and then you hear bam, bam, our air defense system working, and then you just look in your application, and it says ballistic missiles are coming. Ballistic missiles, 2-3 minutes, and it's there. So then you hear a louder explosion, right? You don't fully understand, and then 3 o'clock in the morning, it stopped, and then the whole city was in smoke. Something was burning, and I just had to shut down windows because you couldn't breathe, and then half of the day next day, it was all in smoke. So people were would wear masks just like we did during
and
COVID.
This is what Ukrainian people living in Kyiv are living through every day. So you're back for a return visit as the ambassador, but the experience you're having in that short time back is the daily life.
Daily life. And, you know, and we also, as part of our annual ambassadors meeting, we went to Zaporizhia. And Zaporizhia is only the southeastern part of Ukraine. It's an industrial city on the river Dnipro. It's only 40 kilometers from the front line. And I've seen some of those buildings destroyed. So 3,000 residential buildings in Zaporizhia are damaged.
Yeah.
Some are damaged, like you can't live there. Some are damaged, you can still live there, right?
Yep.
But 3,000. Can you imagine?
Well, you think about Canberra.
Correct. So it's still up to 1 million people there. So it's a big city. Oh, it used to be 1 million.
They're
probably
still living in the
city. Half a million probably still live there.
Yeah, some will have left, but some
Some are still there, especially elderly people. They don't have money to move. They kind of like, you know, they just cannot afford to move out. Yeah. You know, a lot of families moved and left, women and kids left, but many still are there. People are kind of like, you know, you stick to your own stuff.
It's
and
their
plus,
place.
Yeah, it's their place. Plus, you know, people are poor. And if you're poor, well, at least you got a place where you can live. But come to anywhere in Ukraine, I mean, you'll be struggling. You don't have a job. You don't need to make a living. Moving abroad is even more difficult because you come into a different environment, but you don't speak foreign languages. And people are petrified of that. So only the most courageous women have taken their kids to Europe. But we have 5 million in Europe right now.
Well, that's a wrenching thing for families as well.
It is.
But one of the most amazing things, I think, has been the strength of the Ukrainian people and the growing strength of the Ukrainian military, because at the start of the war, the Ukrainian military wasn't equipped like it is now and hadn't developed all of its concepts and approaches for using these new weapons of war, drones, counter-drones, electronic warfare. The speed of development of Ukrainian military capability has been incredible.
No, it's staggering progress, because if you look in 2022, it was primarily volunteers who would supply FPV drones to Ukraine, that off the shelf. They would buy it, mostly made in China, and they would send them to front lines. We would use them. So it was never even part of our defense strategy. Correct.
Yeah.
But in 2023, we kind of looked at the number of drones Russians are using. We saw the efficiency of those drones that we got from volunteers, and we came up with a plan. I mean, and I think a lot of that was also driven by American government, where they have seen a failure of our counteroffensive in 2023, because we just couldn't go through the conventional barriers that Russians have built.
I think that's something other militaries have to pay attention to. I get a lot of complacency out of people in our Australian military saying, oh, look, we do combined arms, and we'd be far better than the Russians, far better than the Ukrainians. You know, it's all about combined arms. We'd be able to mass our forces and make breakthroughs and maneuver and be far more integrated. I really doubt that. I really doubt that. I think what we're seeing is the frontier of warfare being demonstrated and developed, and the vulnerability of old ways of war without using these new technologies and concepts.
100%. And was it Mike Tyson who said, everybody has got a strategy until you
get punched
in the face?
Face.
Yeah. So, you know, once you can get punched in the face, very few can actually keep on going, right?
Yes.
And that was, in a way, our lesson, because we got punched in the face when we couldn't go through those three lines of defense which Russians have built in 9 months of occupation.
Yes.
Those landmines and all those three lines. And we didn't have air superiority. We didn't have the fighter jets, and we didn't have long-range missiles to help us out. So it was pretty much, you know, and they would destroy any piece of equipment which would come to the battlefield. You know, tanks now last, 60 seconds on the battlefield?
That's
on
right.
either
so,
side.
So this idea of we'll equip our units like the Americans and do a combined arms assault and have a massive breakthrough.
Yeah.
That didn't happen.
It didn't happen. And it wouldn't happen probably, I'm not sure if Americans would be even able to do it, I mean, in the circumstances we were in, because it's a bit more complicated than people think, right? And hence what prompted us, look, we need to invest into our drone production, right? Of long-range drones, of, FPV drones, cheap drones, and this is where, America supported, other countries have supported. So also we were getting lots of different technology from different countries, right? Including from Australia, by the way.
Yes.
So, and we would deploy that technology to the front line. We see what works, what doesn't. Because a lot of things don't work, actually.
Good. They look good on paper. Like some of the drone systems.
I've heard about switchblades, for instance.
Yes.
I heard they didn't work in Ukraine.
Yes.
So yes. They were jammed immediately by the Russians.
Yeah.
So, and it's also, Russian electronic warfare is very sophisticated.
It was before the war, and it's still developing fast, just like Ukrainian electronic
warfare. 100%. Yeah. So the innovation is so quick in that domain, like every 6 weeks now. Something new comes up every 6 weeks. You know, now the drones which kill people have this fiber optic.
Yes, the control. So it can't be jammed because it's on this.
So, and it's like a fishing line. It's like a fishing line. Yeah. It can go up to 10 kilometers. And then it could be operating in a totally denied environment. And then it still sees what's happening on the ground through that cable. And we use it. Russians now use it.
Yes.
But this is like to counteract all this jamming and electronic warfare.
No, that's still quite short range. A powerful development by Ukraine has been the long-range strike.
And the use of artificial intelligence. And I think this is what we have demonstrated with the spiderweb operation, right?
Yes.
Because we managed to get those drones very close to their major airfields, and then we launched them, and they went into a very highly denied environment, and they destroyed 30% of the Russian strategic bombers, using artificial intelligence, basically, because they just flew in.
Yeah.
They were trained to see Russian military planes, and they hit those planes.
Recognize
them.
The thing about destroying those planes is the Russians can't replace them quickly. So they can replace armored vehicles, they can build drones, but those strategic bombers, I don't think they're even making them anymore.
Yeah, that's what I heard, but, you know, and also, by the way, those were the ones that want to station in Indonesia, you know, that request for
the
airfield.
Yes, the TU-95.
So they wanted to have them in...
Yeah, so you might have done Australia a favor.
We did. You know, I'm not going to paraphrase J.D. Vance on that, but we know the reference. And so my argument is very clear, Michael. A war which seemed to be a long way away in 2022 is actually next door to Australia at the moment. It's happening now here. It's like we don't know what's going to happen in Alaska. Let's see how it goes. Maybe a lot of people will listen to this podcast after it already happened. Nothing may happen. Something may come out of it. Something may not come out of it. It's very difficult to predict in this environment what the outcome could be, because there are like
so many possibilities, uncertainties.
Yeah.
President Zelensky be there.
I don't know.
Will some deal be tried to be done over the heads of Ukraine and Europe? And if so, it won't last. All of these things. It's all just moiling around. But there are some certainties. And I think that is peace is not going to break out next week. Ukraine needs further military and economic and political support.
100%. This is what I'm asking and Australian government to support. And, you know, when I was in Ukraine the other week, tanks been announced, been delivered, a majority of those tanks at Australian government.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, they've been delivered to Ukraine. And it's been almost a year since they've been committed. So they've been committed, and an announcement came in early October of last year.
Yeah.
So we're getting to that 1 year mark. And we had a great contribution to the Ukraine Energy Fund in December when Minister Penny Wong went to Ukraine.
And
she was very good. You know, I'm very thankful to her personally for making that visit. And now, something came out later. And in a way, somebody mentioned to me, you know, at a senior DoD level, garage is empty. And I'm kind of like, well, it's not really true.
We'll tell you that is not true. So the Bushmasters, for example, I think Australia has given Ukraine a total of 120 Bushmaster vehicles. And I think the last announcement of those vehicles was back in 2023. Here we are, 2 years on. The Australian Defence Organisation has about 800 of those Bushmasters in its inventory right now. And it's a live production line down in Bendigo. We could be providing a continual flow of Bushmaster vehicles to Ukraine. And as they're damaged and lost, they can be replaced and repaired. So this idea of not one-off gifts, but a continual flow of support to Ukraine is what's possible for us. We could draw down on some of those 800 vehicles we have in stock and backfill them with new production out of time.
100%. And also it applies to vehicles like M113s, which are kind of Vietnam era.
Yeah, and they're in very good condition.
And we need them actually because they're on tracks, and we use them for medical evacuation. Because now from the front lines, with all these drones, it's impossible to evacuate people, wounded people, because the minute you come to rescue them, you get hit.
Yeah.
And you need some protection. And actually and 56 of those have been donated to Ukraine, but you got another 244
there. This is why It is not true the garage is empty. The garage is chock full. And in the case of things like the Bushmaster, we can fill up the garage more.
And we'd be very grateful to you for that. And also like Hawkeye. Remember the campaign for Hawkeyes? You have like 1,100 of those. I don't know how many, 1,200. And 2 years ago, you had a braking problem. I hope that problem was fixed 2 years later.
This is an automatic braking problem. And I remember hearing people from the Ukrainian forces saying, well, they could manage that on the battlefield. And we were busily explaining how it wouldn't meet our safety standards. And I'm thinking, well, if we're in a war, we might change some of those standards. So I think we've got to listen to the Ukrainian military and what they want. And if we're able to provide it, we should do that.
And let's test those vehicles. Can they actually operate in the air, you know, in the battlefield?
Yeah.
Maybe they don't. Maybe they do. And we can test them and we can make them better. You can make them better as a result of it. Because, you know, those vehicles, they've been used to, change Humvees, right? Mm. So you didn't want to buy Humvees. You decided
They're not officially protected. So the Hawkeye and Bushmaster.
But they're used for electronic warfare, for reconnaissance. They also could be used for air defense because you can mount an NASAM system and it could be used to counteract actually drones or any missiles.
With the Bushmaster, there's a Strike Master version.
Yeah, available. Correct. Yeah. And also you can integrate this remote weapon system from the US and which is going to be used for different purposes.
Including
counter drone, right? This Slinger technology that they now have or some other stuff. So in a way, I mean, you could benefit from supporting us by actually testing your new kit, but also you can learn a lot. And this is, by the way, lessons learned, not only for the battlefield, which is also important for Australia. I mean, and I'm talking about asymmetric warfare. Yes. I mean, you are a small nation, just as we are.
We're never going to have scale through mass unless it's through cheap, low-end systems.
100%. And, you know, so we are dealing with a country which has 140 million people, right?
And it's willing to throw conscripts and prisoners and everyone else into a meat grinder.
You know, over a million Russian casualties. They don't care. They keep on sending more, right? Yeah. And they will do so. It's been Russian traditions deep in their psyche. People are heavily brainwashed, and it's happening.
Putin doesn't care how many Russians die. He's willing to have as many as he needs to die to conquer Ukraine, to reestablish his sense of empire.
Correct. And his plan was to take over Kyiv in 7 days and take over Ukraine in 3 weeks, right? And 3 years later, 3.5 years later, he only controls 20% of the Ukrainian territory, right?
He's chronically embarrassed, but that's also why he can't stop. Yeah. Because if he stops now, it's a disaster.
Disaster.
So because he has no plan for victory. But he can't stop.
And this is exactly what I'm explaining to public in Australia, which people don't understand. I mean, I always get this question, when this will end, right? Mm. And as if we have anything to do with that. And like, look, I mean, it's up to Russia when this war ends. And to be frank, I don't see any motivation from Putin to stop, because how he's going to explain that to his people, he can't, because he told them we're going to take over Ukraine.
He's going to keep falling forward.
Yeah, falling forward, gaining more and more ground. Even if there is some sort of operational pause, which can last this coming winter in Ukraine, he will come back with a bigger war.
Already, even as he prepares to jet off to Alaska, there are good indications that the Russian military is organizing for more offensives, more attacks against the front line, but also against Ukrainian civilians and population.
And he will step up pressure now, just intentionally and deliberately, to make a point, right, that he can keep on going forever unless he is given what he's asking for. And he wants that, you know, remember Potsdam Conference, right?
Yes.
You know, Stalin and Roosevelt meeting and dividing the Europe, right, without Europe being involved. You know, he's a bit apparent. The guy imagines him a new Peter the Great, the new Stalin, whatever.
He's part Catherine the Great, Peter the Great.
Yeah.
He's great.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah.
When he looks in the mirror.
He's in the mirror and he says, oh, America wants to see me in America, right?
Yes.
Last time he went to America was in 2007 to see George W. Bush,
it's
right?
It's an enormous gift to him.
It is.
His propaganda.
If nothing comes out of it, he's already won.
Onto American soil, and also to be welcomed to a part of America that used to be Russian.
Correct.
You're seeing all this stuff about the Russian Orthodox Church and Alaska, and it's almost as if he can't help himself. Mm. He's partly promoting a resurgent Russian empire, even in Alaska.
And he's going to go to that Orthodox Church in Alaska.
Yes,
he's
going to
pray, and he will look like, and all the Americans who go to church will think, oh, look, he's
what
a very religious
man.
Yeah, he's good.
In fact, he's a murderous, brutal killer.
Absolutely.
His own people.
Of his own people. And he's a crook, he's a thug. I mean, and he wants to you know, change history. And this is what he's dreaming about. Because, you know, he's already achieved everything he wanted, Michael. He's the richest man in the world. Yep. You know, he's run Russia forever. He's going to run Russia until he dies.
Those enormous palatial properties, yeah, which I mean, are beyond any.
But it doesn't turn him on anymore, you know?
Yeah, no.
He's get motivated. It's about, you know, changing history.
Yes.
He wants to be seen as Stalin, you know, dividing Europe.
A great figure in history.
Yeah, a great figure in history who's kind of like, you know, regained.
It is of the Russian Empire. But the unfortunate fact for him is the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian people, with the support of the democratic world, are standing in the way of that dream. And what I see out of Europe now is a strengthening of support to Ukraine and a recognition that Ukraine is now the most powerful democratic military power in Europe. The rest of Europe needs Ukraine and needs Ukraine to withstand Russia because you're the front door to European security.
100%. And actually, you know, coming back to our discussion on technology, I think that Australian government should actually work on establishing joint ventures with Ukrainian producers here in Australia. And this was part of some of the discussions that happened recently. And in a way, this is would provide you access to some of the new technology. You would be able to buy directly for your, you know, ADF. Also the same for New Zealand in that respect. New Zealand just now doubled their, you know, defense budget, and they could benefit from some of those systems. And this is how you can, you know, you can even try to license some of that technology from Ukraine. I mean, at this stage, probably we would be reluctant to share that because it's still kind of new. But I think that a lot of that depends on the support we get from Australia.
Well, this is where I think we've got to change the public conversation about Australia just supporting Ukraine and realize Ukraine is an important partner for our own security now. So the UK government, I think, has announced a new joint drone and counter-drone production partnership with Ukraine, which is all about using UK companies and Ukrainian companies to produce the best drone and counter-drone technology. I think the initial focus is counter-drones because that protection of the front line and of civilians is so important. But they're putting about £4.5 billion into it, and that's because it's UK self-interest. Helping Ukraine prevail, but helping its own military get much stronger in areas where it's quite weak. And that same argument applies to Australia. We've got fantastic medium and small companies making drone and counter-drone systems. Some of those have been equipping the Ukrainian military. That's great, but it's been at a very small scale. My thought is the reopening of our embassy is a big opportunity. Imagine if we had a joint Australian defence team with Australian defence industry engaging directly with the Ukrainian military and Ukrainian companies with a proper funding line. That, to me, would be in both countries' interest.
And 100%. And by the way, you now have two defense professionals who are currently at your embassy. One is military, one is civilian from the DoD. I had two meetings with them when I was in Kyiv recently. And they're, you know, they're trying to do what they can under the circumstances. They just moved in there very recently. So they're still new to the city, but they're trying to meet people and get some knowledge about what's happening. But it's good they're on the ground now.
Well, it's
because
great that the
they can assist.
Reopened. Pretty much every other country that is actually a strong partner of Ukraine has had that on-the-ground presence for some time. So we're coming from behind the curve now, but we should make more of the opportunity. I would love to see a new package of military and defence industrial assistance agreed with Ukraine and have it as that two-way partnership. The Germans are doing the same as the UK. It's that investment in Ukrainian production and presence of German companies like Rheinmetall, because it's in Germany's interests for Ukraine to be strong, and the benefits will flow back to the German military.
100%. And I think that Australia can benefit so much from that. Because I remember when I got here and I had this conversation with some your military strategist, and their thinking was, well, Australia needs to have, doesn't need drones. All we need, because we are so isolated,
we don't have some,
you know, capabilities underwater. We need some capabilities in the air and some, you know, strategic naval capabilities. But you know what? I mean, we have demonstrated that we can bring those drones 5,000 kilometers away from the front line and we can hit the target, right?
Yes. Well, and some of it's by pre-positioning shorter range drones.
Yep.
Some of it's by using Ukrainian developed cruise missiles and even, I think, a forthcoming ballistic missile. So Ukraine is a powerhouse of leading edge defense technology.
Yeah.
And so that can be very valuable.
And remember when we hit the Russian Moskva cruiser in the Black Sea? what a win, right? I mean, Russians did not expect that, and it was a huge victory. We destroyed whatever 50% of the Russian Black Sea Navy without even having a navy.
Well, you made their navy stop operating in the sea.
Yeah. So they all are now hiding in the Russian ports.
In protected ports.
Yeah, yeah.
And you even
and we still hit them there.
A submarine.
Yeah, a submarine. Yeah, yeah.
So this is another lesson, I think, for Australia, that in our large Indo-Pacific, some of the Ukrainian techniques and approaches to destroying vessels either in port or while they're at sea, that's very applicable to us as well. So getting over the idea that, well, let's accentuate all the differences so that we don't learn a thing from this war. I think that's a mindset problem we have here.
Look, with people like you and others who talk about it in the public domain, you know, ASPI is organizing the Sydney Dialogue in December. I think it's a very important conference because, you know, they talk about defense, security and technology. And I think this is a very good angle, which I'm trying to get some people from Ukraine to attend, maybe at senior government level, maybe on a business level, because there is a lot which we could share in that forum. You know, this is where I think will be an opportunity for Australian government to meet the Ukrainian officials if they make it. But anyways, the war is still ongoing. I don't see any motivation for Russia to stop. We'll see how those meetings, what the outcome is. But what's important now, Michael, we need to starve Russia of its ability to fund this war.
Yes. And do that. I know we're running out of time, but I'm very glad you got onto this.
Yeah.
And because it's very topical with Donald Trump talking about sanctions on India because India is such a major purchaser of Russian oil. Obviously, China's a major purchaser of Russian oil, so they should be subject to these sanctions if they're to be effective. But there's a very interesting Australian angle here, which is I doubt most Australians driving around in their cars while listening to this podcast suspect that some of the petrol in their tank is from Russian oil, because those Indian refineries that buy cheap Russian oil are some of the refineries supplying Australian petrol.
They do, actually. And if you look, you know, probably the biggest buyer of those petroleum and diesel is still the European Union. But if you take probably a single country, Australia would be number one. If we don't, the buy of that. And
a
lot of those,
a secondary purchaser,
you kind of buy a processed product. But actually, as a matter of fact, some of those refineries are not actually refining anything from Russia. 30% of the stuff they already get refined, and they're just reselling.
They're just on-selling.
Yeah, they're just on-selling. Because
and we've had this revealed to us about Australia's liquefied natural gas. We sell a lot to Japan. Japan on-sells it. But this idea of Russian oil powering Australian cars, I think the average Australian would be horrified to realise that. And there is something we could do, because these are oil companies that respond to government rules, pressure and regulation. The Australian government could put new laws in that penalise foreign oil companies for selling Russian products, including refined Russian products, in the Australian market. There's no reason we couldn't put a price premium.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And of course, it's up to the Australian government to decide how they deal with that matter. But what is clear to me is that, you know, Russian oil and gas sector is providing about 40% of their revenue, right?
Powering their war economy. It's 100%. Letting them produce weapons.
And this is where they get their money from the sale of oil and gas. But oil is the main driver of that, by the way. You know, they operate that shadow oil fleet. Until recently, 30% of that was operating under the Cook Island flags. Believe it or not.
All flags of convenience, and a lot of those vessels are quite decrepit, so there's an environmental risk there.
And they already got crashed in some of the places, and there is a huge risk of oil spills, or we already had some oil spills as a result of it. But then, you know, it's, you know, because it's a commodity, they take it to Malaysia, they mix it up with Malaysian oil, they send it to,
it's
you know,
like
Singapore.
Money laundering, isn't it?
Money laundering.
It's sort of greenwashed through other refineries and other.
And like, for instance, can BP, Viva, you know, Ampol, can they buy something which doesn't have Russian oil there? Probably they can, but they need to make an extra effort, and it all comes down to a market situation.
Well,
because
this is why I'm saying government regulation and law needs to send that market signal to the companies, because while they can mix Russian oil and other products in with their others and sell them at a lower price to everyone, they will do that. It's government law and regulation that changes company behavior.
And, you know, it's a lot of it part of ESG standards. If you were ESG compliant, G is governance. And buying, you know, oil from a country which is a dictatorship, which is funding the largest war in Europe, just doesn't look good. It's not ESG compliant.
No, well, imagine if the mathematics worked out that the package of military assistance Australia's provided to Ukraine, which I think is about 1.5 billion Australian dollars, if that was outweighed by how much money Australian consumers had paid for Russian petroleum products in their vehicles. I suspect the data would show actually we're supporting Russia more by the purchasing of secondary on Russian oil.
And Michael, in a way, I understand that power supply or access to petroleum and diesel is a matter for national security. Because imagine that, I mean, I heard that your stockpile is like 6 weeks or 8 weeks.
We've got a tiny stockpile because we haven't invested in enough storage. The weird thing is we're a massive exporter of energy, but we don't have reserves ourselves.
And you only have two operating refineries, one in Newcastle, one in Geelong. Yep. It's small ones.
They're struggling.
They're struggling. But at the end of the day, in time, if there is, God forbid, any major conflict, right, in your part of the world, like in South China Sea, how much of that trade is going to be disrupted, right? How many tankers can go through Malacca Strait if there is a big war there? Probably none. And what's going to happen to your economy? How are you going to survive that? I mean, how are you going to sell your iron ore? How are you going to get access to your petroleum or diesel? So we are operating in a world where everything is intertwined and our ability to survive depends on the willingness of the democratic countries to step up for Ukraine.
Yes.
As simple as that. Yes. And stepping up for Ukraine can come in different ways, shapes and forms, right? And it could go through military aid, it could go through stopping buying Russian oil, it can go through more sanctions on Russia. And at the end of the day, look, I mean, the structure of your economy is commodity-based. Let's look at prices. You know, when Russia invaded Ukraine, energy prices skyrocketed. Prices for iron ore skyrocketed. Prices for wheat have skyrocketed.
Well, our economy actually benefited.
You benefited. Yeah. You know, I mean, I saw the statistics for the first 2 years of war. Mm. You generated an extra $100 billion of money, which translates into $20 billion tax money. That's a budget surplus the Labour government generated in the first 2 years, right? Yes.
And that was delivered just by the effect, the global effect on prices and demand.
So it was not only inflation and cost of living that everybody talks about. It was a clear benefit for your economy because Russia invaded Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I mean, and nobody has actually, I talk about that in public.
Yes.
And every politician agreed with me, but nobody talks about it in public.
But in a way, that is a dividend we could be using to invest in Ukraine's security. Because we've got this windfall economic benefit because we are a competitor with Russia with what we sell.
100%.
So we had a windfall benefit. Investing that, some of that windfall benefit in helping Ukraine prevail. Make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and look, and I'm, you know, and I'm also making a business case here. I mean, security, defense technology is pretty straightforward. But
this
look,
is your businessman side.
Yeah, and then let's talk about, you know, Ukraine's rebuilt and reconstruction. We'll need your engineering companies to rebuild our infrastructure. We'll need your investors who will come and invest in mining sector. We'll need those who will invest in energy sector in Ukraine. Rebuilding our nuclear power facilities. I mean, they're building our houses and bridges and roads, right? You have some of the major state-of-the-art engineering companies here, like Worley, for instance, right?
We can do engineering in difficult environments. Yep. A lot of that reconstruction.
Or mining infrastructure, right?
This is thinking about a longer-term part.
Yeah, and this is where you can make money. I want Australian companies to make money in Ukraine. Well, this is, I want that the government sees that supporting Ukraine is not only a good thing to do, right? This is, I mean, in strategic national interest. I mean, we already talked about security defense, but I see an economic interest in that. And it goes beyond just minerals. But minerals is a big part of it,
right,
by the way.
Think about back to World War II, post-World War II, the enormous reconstruction of the European countries and economies, which produced a massive world economic boom and the prosperity that came out of that reconstruction of Europe. We've been living on since then. And the reconstruction of Ukraine in the post-war world will likely deliver an enormous benefit to Europe and partners if we're smart enough to be partners.
And I think it's important for Australia to diversify its economy in a way, because we see how dependencies could be used against you, you know.
Yes.
We depended on Russian gas, you know. Yeah. Whole Europe depended on Russian gas.
Yes.
Look what happened, right?
Yeah.
And now they are, you know, they're phasing out, or they almost entirely phased out Russian gas, not entirely, phasing out Russian oil.
They weren't going to do it before the war, but they were forced to do it.
Yeah, and like for Germany, you know, they made a stake on Russian gas because it's cleaner than coal, right?
Yeah.
They stopped all their, you know, coal power generation. They shut down nuclear power facilities. And look what happened, right? And now they are buying, you know, Qatar, they're buying from America. But in a way, it was a huge cost for German economy. And in a way, they could have avoided that if they listened to Ukrainians. And we told them long time ago that reliance on Russian supply of gas is not sustainable. Russians will come and invade us. Well, and they did in 2014. They still kept on building those pipelines.
Yes. Well, that's another realization that's relevant to Australia, that this economic dependency that Europe had on Russia did not prevent war. Economic interconnections do not prevent war.
Unfortunately, and that was, but you see, that's going back into history. It was the way Germany viewed Soviet Union, right? Mm-hmm. It was always like, there's even the German term for that. It's like, we will trade with Soviet Union. And, you know, many Germans believe that Soviet Union collapsed because they cooperated with Soviet Union. I think it's a myth. Remember that when they started buying Soviet gas in the 70s, as Olli Brandt's East Politik kind of strategy, I mean, that was the whole point, was they prolonged Soviet Union by another decade. Because if they didn't...
opening their economy,
You know, sending them Deutsche Marks, you know, with they could use to buy whatever Soviet Union needed. But... That actually funded the war in Afghanistan. This is what Soviet Union used.
Which was another disastrous exercise of Russian power.
Absolutely. Yes. And then it all collapsed because, you know, Soviet Union could not sustain the arms race and they could not sustain the war in Afghanistan. So the whole Soviet Union collapsed. But in a way, of course, Soviet Union allowed Germany to reunite and it allowed Eastern Germany to join NATO, which was a big win for Germany, right? Yeah. Which I'm glad they did. But the fact what they didn't realize was that dependence on Russia and working with Russia, selling, you know, all the luxury cars to Russia and trading that heavily with Russia is not guaranteed that Russia will not turn into a dictatorship, which they did.
No, that's right. They thought it was a two-way power balance through economics, and they were wrong, because what we see through history is dictators and authoritarian regimes don't actually put much value on economics if they want to pursue power and strategic goals. Yeah. They will do that despite it being economically crazy. Yeah. So, look, Ambassador, it's an absolute honour to talk with you. And we've had a very broad historical and current and technological discussion. I hope the listeners enjoy it. What about when the next Australian-Ukraine support package and partnership is developed? We talk again.
Let's do it.
So hopefully that will be very soon.
Very soon. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, sir. We'll be right back.